Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource just for you. It's called 5 Ways to Connect with God. In our busy world, it's easy to feel spiritually dry, but this short guide introduces 5 timeless practices like one-phrase prayers, cultivating thankfulness, and meditating slowly on scripture. They can refresh your soul and draw you closer to God. You can download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get into today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're very pleased to say we've got a guest on the show again today, which is John Heathershaw. How are you, John?
I'm fine. Thanks, Tim.
Well, it's great to have you on. For those who've not come across you and your work before, would you mind kind of explaining who you are and a little bit about what you do these days?
Sure. I'm a professor of international relations at the University of Exeter. I'm not a lifelong academic. Before that, I was in mission for a couple of years. I worked as an aid worker in Central Asia and West Africa. Also worked for the British government as a civil servant in the Ministry of Defence and did a little bit of contract work for the German and US governments, lived in the United States as well. So I guess I've had quite an international life before settling down in Exeter. I'm also from a quite working class background, so I was the first from my family to go to university, and all of my degrees have been funded by the state. When I tell my students often that to receive scholarships through bachelor's, master's and PhD is basically something now that's just not possible. I was the last generation of Britons to have that. And so I feel privileged really to be where I am and blessed by God.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. We've got a long list of things we'd love to dive into. But before we get stuck into the kind of nitty gritty, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your own journey. I mean, there can't be that many of your colleagues who have been aid workers overseas, worked for the Ministry of Defence, and now end up teaching international relations. Could you just share a little bit about how those various kind of, would you call them callings, kind of unfolded?
Yeah, I think one of the things I do when I'm talking to students is to try and say, well, look, you don't try and plan out too much your own career. You know, they're very much encouraged to do that now with this idea of employability. And, you know, for me, God put things in place. I could speak in detail about some of those scholarship opportunities that became available, relationships that were hugely formative for me. And so I think, you know, each step there was by the grace of God. It wasn't always the 100% right choice or the thing that I really wanted to do, but I learned something from it. And yet there was this sense that I had to come back to the academy in the end, because I'm the kind of thinker who likes coming up with ideas that are a little bit uncomfortable in a sort of government environment, for example. So when I was a civil servant, it was a bit of a square peg in a round hole phenomenon. So there was all this movement of, I think, God's work in my life. Maybe a secular person would just call it serendipity. But yes, it was extremely important for me. And what I really value, the fact that I worked in government and in aid work, was that I have this sort of practical background. So my academic research is characterized by a deep skepticism towards any sort of big theory and large generalizing abstract claims, because it's just, they just don't work out when they actually hit the real world, to be honest.
That's really interesting, because I really resonate with a lot of that. My own story of sort of serendipity and seeing strange directions that I ended up, and similarly working as a practicing clinician and also academic, it's the same thing. You know, you know that all these highfalutin academic ideas in the real world, in the nitty gritty, they just are a load of rubbish. And so there is something about being rooted in the practical delivery, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is so important.
When you're an aid worker in particular, was it kind of frustrating to have these kind of chin-stroking left-wing intellectuals back in the comfortable West telling you what life is like in the developing world and what really works?
You're not stereotyping at all, Tim, are you?
Well, am I wrong, John?
It kind of reminds me how old I am, and I'm not that old, I suppose. But, you know, I was first an aid worker in 1998. So this is before WhatsApp, before the global internet. And so I was communicating back home through a monthly, very expensive telephone call and letters to my then girlfriend, now my wife. And so I didn't have that sort of sense of friends say, oh, it must be really difficult for you out there, and why don't you do this, that, or the other. It was just such a wonderful environment, actually. My boss was African. He was a Sierra Leonean pastor. I was working with refugees from Sierra Leone. It was the United Nations United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees project there in that part of West Africa I was in. But I was fully immersed. And then it was when I came back to the UK to study my master's degree, and we were looking at development studies in this quite abstract way. And then you think, well, actually, it doesn't really work like that. But then thankfully, I found that, because there's always a field of academic inquiry that goes to the next level and says, how does this work in practice? So there's something called the ethnography of aid, which gets into how aid really works and how it serves different interests and things. So I just went to that. And I suppose that's why I've stayed in academia and haven't been sort of deeply frustrated with it, because you can just follow your curiosities and you can kind of reconceptualize things. And so that's how I consider my work, really.
And I suppose international development and aid work at the moment is completely in flux with the kind of Trump administration's gutting of US aid, the UK is cutting back. Like, it's quite, I guess we've seen a flowering of aid, is that fair to say, in the last 20 years that's now being radically cut back?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very sad, actually, for many of the organisations that benefited from that. So I'm not really thinking of the kind of big UK or Western-based aid agencies. They certainly have suffered. Some of them have gone under. But I'm thinking more of their partners overseas who were their contractors and who they worked with. And for them, you know, I know a number of organizations that have really just been devastated by the aid cuts from the UK and the United States. And on the very granular level, they were doing incredibly important humanitarian work. They may not have been transforming the world into a beautiful, prosperous world of liberal democracies, but they were helping individual people and villages. And that's really at the level we should be concerned, not this grandiose, you know, headline-grabbing version of international aid.
And really, there's a very positive story, isn't there? You know, if you just, again, avoid the meta-narratives of sort of post-colonial, all that stuff, and just ask what was actually going on the ground. I mean, I saw this in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, the positive impact of Western aid. But, of course, a very mixed picture. I mean, I'm sure you've seen many examples of where money is massively wasted and inappropriate and incentives and all that kind of stuff. And yet, at a grassroots level, some amazing
positive
stuff.
Yeah, I think this
stuff
is a theme that we may come back to in the conversation about scale. So whenever you do a project at a big, grandiose scale and everything works through, say, the central government in a particular African country, that government's almost certainly going to be highly corrupt to some degree. So you'll get a lot of money wasted. There'll be lots of money spent on expensive foreign consultants who will come in and tell you how to spend it, things like that. I did a little bit of that work myself, so I saw from the inside what bigger problem that is. But then at the local level, you can do things. And we as Christians know this, because there's lots of great aid work done essentially to church-to-church partnerships, where there's a lot of volunteering. It's incredibly good value for money, and it can be really transformative. And that's the kind of aid work which does also need sort of big disbursements of funding going into the sort of system. That's the kind of aid work which works. And it's often that we don't see. We hear about the big projects that the Daily Mail will satirize as, you know, supporting some kind of lesbian pop group in Uganda or something. But that's just so non-representative of aid.
And just, I mean, this is where we come to some of the themes of our discussion. You know, just going back historically, you know, in the post-war era, and is it particularly in the 70s and 80s when there was really a remarkable move, a transfer of funding, particularly from the US, but also from other Western European countries, And I suppose the question to me, you know, is how much of that was motivated by Christian understandings of loving, of neighbor love and so on? How much of it was motivated by other much more crude political...
Yeah, I mean, again, this is another common theme. So you have in what we call the liberal international order, which by the end of the 20th century led to this big surge of aid. After the end of the Cold War, the UK and some other countries committed to spend 0.7% of their gross domestic product on aid. The US Agency for International Development was created during the Cold War, was the biggest donor worldwide, and has been essentially destroyed by the Trump administration now. But, you know, when you had aid, what you had was a mix of big grandstanding, sort of national branding. We are Americans, Brits, doing great things to the world, alongside some sincere desire to help others, a humanitarianism which I think has deep roots in our history, which has been affected by Christianity. And so you have to be careful about how we frame that. So I think that what we have in politics is a sort of approximate version of some Christian ethics. And what we have in the secular world is a version which relies very much on a Christian set of moral foundations, but which gets kind of transformed a little bit in a sort of quite relativizing way. So lots of the kind of core foundational claims about things that might be difficult now, like the absolute moral good coming from God, and that we're made in the image of God, and that there's a need for repentance in situations of armed conflict or violence, for example, or any moral problems. I think those kinds of things kind of get a little bit lost, the doctrinal things, but then the ethical things are still very much there. And it's very hard to think about Western political or humanitarian ethics outside of a Christian framework.
Do you buy into the kind of what's sometimes called the kind of Tom Holland thesis? You know, that kind of the Western liberal secular order is actually a kind of thinly veiled Christian heresy, and it's all completely incomprehensible without Christendom and centuries of these deep-rooted Christian beliefs, even if no one kind of espousing it really realizes that.
I do at a very general level, because it's not just the Tom Holland thesis. There's a book every decade for the last 100 years that have made that argument, and it's quite compelling, actually. But the interesting thing about Tom Holland's argument, and I think what makes it so compelling, is that he recognises that Christian and Christian theological arguments they are polyvalent. They can enter into multiple sides of the debate. So I think the final chapter of the Dominion book is on woke, and he shows how both Christian arguments were both for woke and against. And I think this is what you have when you have particularly this, what we call post-Christendom. So after this sort of dominance and single consolidated vision of a sort of Christian nation falls down, then you have these competing Christian ideas over what it is to be good and virtuous, and that he captures that quite nicely, I think, in the Dominion book.
Yeah, it's a fascinating insight that, in other words, the richness of Christian theology, which has sort of evolved over 2,000 years, you know, I like this word polyvalent, that it can operate in different ways. It's a very rich, complex tapestry of ideas, and you can select out of that tapestry particular bits you like and ignore other bits you don't like, and yet really it comes as a package deal in some ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And without wanting to sort of just end up in a sort of golden mean position, we do need to listen to conservatives who say that it's very hard to have a country governed well without a sense of sort of common shared values. And I think that's what we're experiencing now. We're seeing, you know, factions with warring values, and that creates a lot of the temper of our times.
And I guess thinking more recently, this is how you can see, you know, so we're probably going to come and talk about it in more detail, the recent kind of Christian nationalist rally in central London a few weeks ago, Unite the Kingdom. There are those there waving crosses, chanting Christ is King. They think they're the true Christians. And there is another group saying this is evil, sinful, racist, divisive, hateful. We're the true Christians, and kind of both sides, as you say, drawing on some of that deep well of Christian thought and yet coming at radically different perspectives on the central issue of migration, asylum seekers, you know, what makes the UK, who should live here, etc.
Yes, we can go on to that if you like. I mean, I have a view on that.
Let's go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the church is facing an issue now of how to respond to Christian nationalism in the UK. I wrote something about this last week on my blog on Substack. It's called Security After Christendom, named after the book I published in 2024. And I think the key issue here is that vision of a Christian hope embodied in a Christian nation is ultimately false and non-biblical. And there is a distinction between a country with important Christian voices that are prophetically holding government to account and a Christian country. And that categorical shift is in many ways the whole ballgame of political theology. It is the debate about Christendom or post-Christendom. And those of us who stand on the post-Christendom side would say there is a deep problem with using the state as the vehicle through which to proclaim the gospel or an approximation of the gospel. And it really does mean that you are getting in bed with power, which fundamentally works at a different level and works to advance special sectarian interests over others, works in a bordered way. And that bordered way is not the way of the kingdom of heaven. It's not what we as church are called to do. So when church steps into that political realm and inhabits it, it makes these very serious errors, which lead to, I think, terrible violence in many cases in our history.
This seems to be very much related to the whole concept of the nation state. And for those of us who aren't political historians, I mean, could you give us just a sort of thumbnail sketch about, because I think most people who don't have this sense of political history, we would assume, well, nation states have been here ever since, you know, the time of the Bible, haven't they? There was Egypt, and there was, you know, other countries, and they were all warring, and so what's the big deal? But I think you would want to argue that there was something different about the nation state as it was invented later on.
Completely. I think the nation state as we see it now is really in a mature form, only about 200 years old, and it, with its hard borders and very strong central government. If you look at things like the volume of a national economy, which is consumed by the state, which is not going down, by the way, we might see states being less effective, but they still take a large portion of a national economy's resources. And they've kind of created that phenomenon by building up this institutional capacity. That was a 20th century phenomenon. In the 19th century and a little before that, we had emergent nationalism, which said that this hard-bordered state, that the way to control politics, the way to do politics, was to have hard borders, strong central governments representing a single nation. That's all very, very new. So when the Bible talks about a nation of Israel, it's talking about a special, chosen, holy people set apart for God. It's a very different way of understanding it. It also talks about Israel as being a person. It talks about Israel in many, many ways. So to sort of simply equate that kind of understanding of a nation to modern day one, it is nonsense, really. And it's inconsistent with the covenantal tradition of Christian theology, where we see the church coming in with Christ to kind of like be the new people of God. And so to sort of go from nation of Israel to nations today, which is the classic sort of Christian nationalist move, is a fundamental misreading of scripture, really. And in terms of political history, it's also a fundamental misreading of the way things have evolved. So to get back to that, polities in the ancient world were often city-states. Again, they were rarely bordered. They were also empires. Again, even empires weren't really bordered. They had these kind of relationships of a gift and tribute with other political entities. They were paying into the system. So there wasn't a sort of sense of the modern nation state we have today. That's a really recent phenomenon. And like other political vehicles, it's going to pass away. It's not going to be here forever. We shouldn't be putting our theological stock in this kind of entity called the nation state when it's such a modern phenomenon.
To try and kind of steel man the other side for a second, I guess, what would you respond to someone who says, of course, Christians believe that we are citizens of the New Jerusalem, our true citizenship is in heaven, we appreciate that the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland is a kind of historically man-made thing that will not last forever, or certainly not into the new world, but we also want, you know, here on earth as in heaven, we want to try and build, while we're waiting for the eschaton, for the unveiling and the consummation of all things, we want to try and build societies here that kind of reflect the way of Jesus. And pragmatically, in the modern world, to do that, you need to work through nation states, because that is how the world works. There are borders, there are laws, there are authorities and institutions and passports and citizenship. And so therefore, it makes pragmatic sense for those of us who have been born by a fluke of accident of birth to be British Christians, to seek to make Britain as Christian as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with almost all of that, maybe apart from the as Christian as possible at the end. What I would take issue with is exclusively focusing on the nation state. So what I would argue for is certainly not a kind of Benedict option where we all retreat into these beautiful, holy Christian communities and keep ourselves apart from the world. Rather, what we have to do is to be part of that breaking in of the kingdom of God into the world by prophetically proclaiming that into politics. And, you know, and there's a very clear model of that, which emerges out of the Bible, keeping that distance from politics. As we see, you know, what Christ calls us to do, he's not interested in like reconstituting the nation of Israel in the way that that the disciples expect him to do. He's not interested in fighting the sort of political battle. But it's not that he's not speaking into politics. If you look at how he's going about his ministry at that time. And so I think we too have to have that distance from the world while speaking into the world. And so the object is the world. It's not the nation state. The world includes the nation state. It includes businesses. It includes civil society. It includes international organizations. It is not confined by national borders. And so I think it's a little bit, I think, philologically incorrect and historically naive to pick out this one entity and say, that's all we're going to speak to. And if we can put up some strong borders around this community and make a Christian nation within that community, then we'll be safe. I don't think there's really a good, strong historical or theological basis for that. So I think that's the problem, really. And so also when you get to that point of we're going to make it as Christian as possible, then you go back to this history where, you know, there were plenty of groups trying to do that around the time of the Reformation. And it usually meant they were killing other Christians, actually, or excluding them, because we can't agree on these secondary matters of how to govern ourselves. We might agree that Christ died on the cross and he's forgiven our sins and there's a resurrection. But these are other matters that Christians disagree upon. So if you get a Presbyterian state, what are they going to say to the Free Church people? Or an Orthodox, Christian Orthodox state, what are they going to say to the Catholics? You know, and it just raises all kinds of problems as soon as you begin to inquire of Christian nationalism. I think that's why there are no compelling theological portraits of what this is. It's more of a cultural zeitgeist. It's a kind of, it's a feeling of loss about the way our country's going. And so we're going to respond to that by being quite angry, actually, and but not really articulating good, solid theological and historical arguments.
It does seem that the American, you know, it's often been said that America and Britain are sort of divided by a common language. You know, although we speak the same language, it often seems as though what's happening in the States is really very different from here. And yet so much of it comes across the pond, doesn't it? You know, the power of the media, the internet, the big tech companies, Silicon Valley, all that stuff means inevitably that as a little country, we are very much buffeted by events that are going on in the States at the moment. And how do you see this and how should we be responding, particularly, you know, as church leaders or as those trying to guide Christian people? How do we respond to this extraordinary events that are happening in the States?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I was in the States in February and March, really at the height of the Doge period, and I had the privilege of speaking to National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. between the services. And in that church, you've had vice presidents and senators worship there in the past. You have many, many senior officials. And there was so much thirst for a kind of a waypoint, really. How do we get to somewhere better than where we are now? How do we respond to this? Lots of worry and concern. I think it's quite hard to be that Christian voice in the workplace where you are saying, hang on, is this wise? Is this generous to our colleagues? Is this consistent with appropriate limited government? And when you've got political appointees coming into parts of government and enforcing a vision which is kind of out of keeping, really, from the history of government in the United States, which, you know, let's be honest, has been a model for much of the world. So there's that at the level of government. And for those people, anyone responsible who's looking at that, whether they identify as a Christian or not, and I was trying to give some advice about how one can step back from that and protect one's colleagues and things, just talking to colleagues, friends of mine who work within the US government. But then I think there's this kind of bigger issue for Christians about the church and how it's been politicized, and how then it's broadcast a kind of conservative, political, charismatic, typically charismatic evangelicalism into the church as a whole. And I think that's difficult without just saying there's a certain amount of idolatry going on here and calling that idolatry out. And I actually explored this again in that blog on security after Christendom last week, where I think there's maybe three responses that the church in the UK can have to the phenomenon of Christian nationalism coming from the United States to the UK. One is to shun it and say it's just not and keep on the gospel, we want nothing to do with it. I don't think that's viable anymore. Might have been my position 10 or 20 years ago, but I think it's not enough. The second is to try and salvage some of it, to say within this, there's some kind of vision of a sort of country which is virtuous and valuable. And the third is to supersede it, to say that this is not the vision for Christian involvement in politics. There is a vision for Christian involvement in politics, which is distant from the state, but this is not it. And this is why that's not it. And so I do think we have to take that third option of superseding what is going on in there, and not simply shunning it and ignoring it, but trying to say, well, actually, this isn't the Christian vision for involvement in politics. And it does engage in idolatry.
I think one of the challenges, I've been reflecting on this a lot in the context of reporting on the UK church, is that so many of kind of UK church leaders are instinctively kind of upper middle class, soft left, kind of centrist liberals who find a lot of the Tommy Robinson inflected politics at the moment deeply distasteful anyway. And so their instinct, you know, when they might see flags, England flags tied up on lampposts near their home, is to kind of, you know, shudder and move on. And yet that doesn't really seem to do justice to the levels of disaffection and frustration and anger that lots of ordinary British people, many, you know, most of whom aren't dyed-in-the-wool far-right racists, but are deeply frustrated with the state of our politics. And so for reasons I don't understand, some of them are kind of clinging to those Christian symbols or rhetoric, whether it's holding a cross, putting on a crusader outfit, or chanting Christ is King in Trafalgar Square. How can those who don't share those politics but still have a kind of heart to reach out with something of the gospel to, is there an opportunity there? Is that almost like a silver lining that people are open to seeing Jesus-shaped responses in this political moment, even if they're obviously taking that in a slightly unhealthy direction?
Yes. I mean, I come at this from being from a working-class background in the sort of coal fields of North Nottinghamshire, South Yorkshire, where the parliamentary constituency I'm from was solid Labour until in 2019 it turned Conservative and voted for Boris Johnson. It voted 70% for Brexit. That's my friends and relatives, my school, my failing school that I went to secondary school. So I get all of that. But it's still, the people who are so angry about this still live in one of the richest countries in the world with a welfare system which isn't might be worse than it was 20 years ago, but it's reasonably okay. The NHS, however weakened it's been, is still better than what most countries have. And it seems to me that a great deal of the sentiment and emotional energy going into this is a failure to recognize things which I personally am responsible for that have made my life difficult as well. So there is this question of individual responsibility around, you know, persons, their contexts are one that may be of declining health, their contexts of families weakening and breaking up. The government is not responsible for those things. It may have done some things that make that more likely to happen as the economies become maybe more unequal and things like this, but it's a complex picture. And I think the message of the Christian church is that you can't have this part of the whole. You can't have some kind of vision of a city on a hill, of a great Christian nation, without recognizing the need for repentance and forgiveness of one another. And the fact that all persons of whatever background, you know, Jew or Greek, slave or free, can be part of this. And so I think that, yeah, there's an opportunity. And there's a conversation I know at the moment about, you know, this, what's the Bible Society is called, the Quiet Revival. It's a difficult opportunity for the church because the people coming in are both the wannabe Christian nationalists on the one hand and the kind of liberal, I want to take Christianity on my terms so it affirms my particular identity. And those people often don't mix at all in society. So we've got both those groups coming to church, and we've also got lots of internationals and new immigrants coming into church. But it seems to me the only place where you could have the mixing and the conversation between those groups is really in church. And actually, my church has people that, to some degree, represent all three of those groups I've mentioned. And I think that's the challenge, to build a different kind of community, which is still a political community, but is not the community being imagined in the heads of these sort of proto-Christian nationalists.
Wrestled with tough questions about faith, or maybe you've had a friend who's skeptical about Christianity. That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hands of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable: Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics, and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe, and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your book today. Now, on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
That's really helpful and very, very compelling. But can I sort of put to you the thing which I just find the most intractable and hard to understand? And that is, we have, you know, in the Christian faith, this wonderful vision of welcoming strangers, of you know, of Jesus as the one who is there for everybody, and 2,000 years of amazing examples where the church has done that. And now we find ourselves, you know, here in the early parts of the 21st century, living in a world where there are vast areas of failed states, of horrific abuse, and hundreds of millions of desperate people. And then we have these huge disparities of wealth. We have these rich countries, which understandably, you know, I try to put myself in a young man in Syria, you know, and thinking, what would I be doing? And I think I would be desperately trying to get on those boats. I would be. But there's just no way that a small country like UK could practice that kind of hospitality to strangers. Or should we? Is that what the Christian voice says? I mean, and I suppose this is where the borders question. Yeah, of course, I hear what you're saying about borders. That's a new issue. And yet, given this geopolitical reality, don't we need borders?
Yeah, we do. And I think that point about open borders is a point about the community of the church. It's not a point about the community of the state. And I think this is, again, where we have to be careful about the categories we use. So I think, you know, the Christian role isn't just to be church. It is to proclaim into the state things that it could do better. So I'm happy with that. I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing that. And I don't think a Christian proclamation to the state would be completely open borders. I think it would probably be a fair and just system. I think it would be things like increasing the number of humanitarian visas for people to come to the UK. So you're undercutting not just the supply of people, not just the smugglers, but the demand to come. And, you know, the UK has just not taken anywhere near as enough people on the UNHCR resettlement programs as it could have done. And it's also, it's done it in such a way which is astonishingly expensive for the public purse, as opposed to having a proper community resettlement scheme of the kind of thing that we saw that emerged when Ukrainians arrived nearly 4 years ago. So there's so many things that could be done better. The church is modelling those already. And I'm part of an international cafe project in Exeter, where we actually go out to the asylum seekers hotel on the edge of the city. It's been going great for 2.5 years until the far right campaign whipped up the protests over the summer. And after 2.5 years, we finally had protests outside that hotel, which were terrible. But as a group, we then didn't join the kind of anti-fascist counter-protesters and say, oh, open borders, whatever. We said, no, hang on, what you think about this place isn't correct. And it's not the case that it's actually packed full of single men. It's actually just families and children. And so we were able to kind of try and intervene there. So I think there's this kind of, there's just a different Christian witness, a different Christian proclamation. But we do also, and this is the final thing I'll say on this for now, but we also have to say that there's a certain element of false premise around this sort of sense of a flood of people coming. The vast majority of refugees are in countries next to armed conflicts. There's way more refugees in Turkey and Jordan. There's massive physical barriers to get to the UK. Yes, they're coming across the EU where they could have claimed asylum, but we refuse to be part of a system of proper distribution when we were back in the European Union before 2016. Because we left the European Union, we can't be part of the Dublin process, which doesn't work very well anyway. But it doesn't work very well because lots of countries like Britain didn't cooperate and take part in it. And so you can't have this system of Britain doesn't even know where individuals may have first been registered as refugees somewhere in Southern Europe, because we're not part of that system, because we left the European Union. And this is why institutions matter, right? You know, and that's why you can't just make these broad sovereignty claims in a referendum like in 2016, because there are specific things there which actually allow us to manage these problems better. And part of the reason 10 years on why we're managing them so poorly and we haven't been able to control the flow of migrants or refugees is we've taken a series of decisions responding to anti-migrant sentiment which have weakened our capacity to do so. So I think there's that. That's the sort of proclamation, a prophetic proclamation back to those people that say, oh, you know, there's too many migrants. Well, yes, there are, maybe in hotels. They shouldn't be in hotels. But we can do it so much better if we have a better national system and a better international system. And we still have far fewer refugees than many, many other countries that are much poorer than us.
There's really strong points there, John. I mean, I've always reflected as there's a deep, bitter irony. Speaking as someone who is a loud and proud Remainer, but, you know, clearly the Brexit vote was in many ways motivated by a desire to reduce migration. And yet in the years since we finally left the EU, migration, both legal and illegal, has spiraled to significantly higher levels, despite us having taken back control, in inverted commas. But anyway, I was surprised. I was noted that you talked about institutions and kind of international multilateralism. Mm. And I wanted just to draw a little bit attention to your book. You mentioned a few times Security After Christendom and an associated blog, which I strongly recommend. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a kind of core tenet of the book is that kind of true security that people are longing for is an eschatological thing that will only finally arrive in the person of Jesus when he returns. And so I wondered, what was your take? What would your view be to... Because I think a lot of people, and we touched on before, would say the kind of post-war attempt to construct a rules-based order with things like, you know, the UNHCR and international law and multilateralism and declarations of human rights, that was a kind of Christendom-derived project, you could argue. Was it always a doomed enterprise, in your view, if true security, true that people are yearning for, is actually an eschatological reality?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's a matter of distinguishing between a political analysis and an eschatological analysis, and then thinking about a relationship between those two. So, you know, no political enterprise that is an enterprise to order the affairs of our world, where how power works, and maybe administer a certain amount of justice, but also achieve security. They're a kind of political enterprise. None of that is ever going to is eschatological in a sense of those states aren't going to last forever. They're not going to achieve absolute security. They're not going to achieve absolute victory in war, no matter what Netanyahu thinks he's doing in Gaza right now. And hopefully the Trump process will actually lead to something. But yeah, politics has those limits. And a realistic, a Christian realist perspective on politics will recognize those limits. Eschatologically, we have that vision in Revelation 21 and 22 of what the world will be. So that, and that's true security. So the question then is, what's the relationship between those two things? And for me, that is through the apocalyptic. Now, when I use the apocalyptic, I don't mean a kind of zombie apocalypse or the sort of popular culture version. I mean this literal sense of apocalypse, which is an unveiling, a breaking in. So there's this final moment of rupture and a final achievement of this wonderful new heaven and new earth. But then there's this momentary, the apocalyptic's always occurring since Christ. There's these moments of breaking in, these moments of true peace and security, just for in a certain space and time, for a limited period of time. And our job as Christians is to try and maximize those and to achieve more of those, not by capturing government, but by through more from the bottom up. And I think that is the vision that comes through the church, modeling ways of including others, modeling ways of protecting others, modeling ways of providing provision to others. These are the three elements of security that I pick up on the book. Any idea of any notion of insecurity has inclusion, protection and provision. So national security is all about protecting and providing for our people over everyone else. But the Christian view is not that. It's inclusive. It's radical vision. And so then the question is, this post-war international order that you mentioned, the rules-based international order as it's framed after 1945, the United Nations system, all the kind of international human rights treaties, the Genocide Convention, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and all that stuff. Is that a reasonable approximation of some of those kind of ideas of the breaking in of these promises of security? And I think, you know, in large part, much of that was, and it achieved certain things. What it didn't do is impose a set of universal rights that we all agree to and abide by consistently. But what it did, and this is what I've seen, is in places in the world where you have deeply authoritarian governments, it provided a mechanism by which they could be embarrassed into releasing a few political prisoners or changing their laws a bit. And that made real practical differences. It didn't make real practical differences forever. And there are more authoritarian states now in the world than there were 20 or 25 years ago. But it achieved something in that moment in that time. So if you, it's about being realistic about what your political ambition is. You're not going to change the world through the liberal international order, but a few individuals and places in the world are going to benefit dramatically. And that's enough, because that's happening every day in different parts of the world. Maybe it's happening a bit less now because we're in a moment of change and these institutions are breaking down. And that's part of the apocalyptic too. And that's really important. Maybe we can come back to that. But it certainly did achieve certain moments of justice, certain moments of democracy. And you know, these are important things.
Can I, come back to this sort of the breaking down, because it certainly feels to me that we are living at an extraordinary moment now when, as you say, there seems to be a rise of authoritarian governments around the world. It appears as though that whole rules-based order is under threat. I think there are lots of questions asking, you know, can democracy survive? And one of the things we've often touched on in this podcast is the role of technology in all this, because, you know, you have now this extraordinary phenomenon of mainly US-based technology coming out of the private sector. Well, a sort of a combination between the state and the private sector, which is now sweeping across the world. What's your take on trying to get your head around what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that technology presents a challenge for democracy, because it takes autonomy out of human hands and puts it into a series of generative artificial intelligence bots, programs, etc., or it just through high technology, through things like unarmed aerial vehicles, autonomous drones, you know, actually places decisions around killing and warfare into the hands of technology. So it's a big challenge for something like the just war tradition, for example. And it's certainly a challenge for democracy, because, you know, it turns out that most people aren't sort of reading from multiple perspectives all the time, or stepping back and thinking, oh, what does the other person think about that? But they are actually in Facebook or online communities, social media communities, where they really want to be hearing other people who are affirming them and saying the same things as them. So it turns out that sort of Christian sense of the problem of pride and our tendency to want to be told we're right, and that problem of sin is a big issue in politics, because we then get into these little communities and technology enhances this, where we only hear from like voices as ourselves. So again, I think there's a certain inevitability to that happening in a fallen world. And again, as churches, what we need to model is something completely different. So that means things like we should relish and seek out churches which are politically diverse. I wouldn't want to be in a church where everyone thought the same as me. If I was a conservative in the United States, I wouldn't want to be alongside everyone who felt, you know, there should be no legal right to abortion, or everyone who felt that Donald Trump was the savior of the world. Equally, if I was on the left, you know, if I was a gay Christian, I'm not sure I'd want to be in a church which was just absolutely 100% affirming. And that's a difficult thing to say. I'm not a gay person. So I know people might feel threatened by being in an environment where others don't maybe recognize their right to be affirmed. But if what we're looking for is affirmation all the time, then we're not engaging in an enterprise which is properly some form of discipleship and what Christian theologians call sanctification. We need to be challenged. And so we need to model witness, if you like, forms of community, which they're not really democratic, because they're sort of Christocratic, if you like. You know, Christ is the head. There's an approximation of democracy that comes out of the Christian tradition in the ways I've kind of just talked about, because we should be being challenged. We should want power to be dispersed. So that kind of modelling, which has been really important, was really important in the 16th, 17th, 18th century as democracy emerged in Western countries. That's what we need to do as church. And I think that's the only way really to kind of provide some health to an increasingly diseased democracy.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So this idea that it's the church that is God's new society, that is modelling a different form of community. And therefore, and within that community, I'm immediately thinking of Paul talking about body life, that, you know, the very definition of body life is that there are very different roles, different gifts, and yet all organically somehow finding a unity in the Lordship of Christ. I mean, it's a wonderful vision. It often feels, doesn't it, as though our local church communities come a very long way away from that vision, but it is a, particularly at this moment of polarization and of sort of hate-filled attack, how can we promote that vision more effectively?
Yeah. I mean, the other parts of Paul I might go to would be, you know, shine like stars in a crooked generation, but also do not conform to the pattern of this world. Shine like stars can sound like celebrity, but celebrities typically do conform to the pattern of this world. That's why they're celebrities. Whereas our vision is somewhat different. It's that kind of, it is that breaking in. It's that being of salt, to use another biblical metaphor, salt and light. And so I think just being a little bit unorthodox and being open, you know, what I don't want is the arguments I made earlier that Christian nationalism is idolatry. And as far as I'm concerned, it is. I think that's pretty clear. I don't want that to be seen as a dismissal of people who have conservative views or people have very different views to me. So I do think we need to keep that kind of conversation open. We need to recognize the value in other people's ideas. Let's take an example, maybe in, I don't know, this would be interesting to hear from you too, because I know of your expertise, particularly John. You know, there may be some issues around life issues, around things like abortion and various treatments that are now available that we as church should be a bit more concerned about, and the Americans are more concerned about than we are, perhaps. And so we could learn from them on some of those issues, perhaps. So I do think we need to have that kind of openness to the alternative, to the different, to the thing that we're not typically talking about and not comfortable talking about.
I guess one of the core things that kind of runs through democracy is, you know, to use the famous phrase, it's about George or not war, war. It's about ways of resolving differences without resorting to violence. And I suppose part, an element of the, that kind of liberal international order was again saying, you know, from times gone by, it was, the international order worked on might makes right. The stronger, more powerful, wealthier countries enforced their preferences over smaller countries. And as you know, there was an attempt to try and ameliorate that to an extent. And my perspective is that that is breaking down in an international sense. And we're increasingly moving to a world in which might makes right. And you see that very clearly in places like Ukraine. You know, a border state within the sphere of influence, and you have the great men of Trump and Putin talking over the head of Zelensky and the Ukrainians, carving up their country like it's the Cold War again. What does the Christian voice, the gospel, have to say in a world where kind of might makes right? Because that's just completely antithetical to the way of Jesus, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's lots of examples, isn't there, in across the Bible, from the great empires that are covered in the Old Testament to the preaching of Revelation on sort of dragon and beasts and things like this, of empires, which they have that vision in mind of might makes right, but they never quite achieve it. And I think that's also what we see in Ukraine and Gaza. So it's undoubtedly the case that Ukrainians are suffering and the weaker party, for example. But Putin's vision, which is this, it is actually a civilizationalist, Christian-inflected vision of Russia's, the Russian world, is not being achieved. You know, he really did feel like it would be a quick war and he could subordinate the Ukrainians, and that's not happened. So there's a lot of might makes right going on, but might doesn't achieve its stated objectives. And we know it doesn't achieve that because it's based on unrealistic and grandiose claims about what warfare can achieve or what politics can achieve. So it does a lot of destructive damage, but it's often not great at constructing enduring orders. And I think you could say the same about, you know, Netanyahu's maximalist ambitions in Gaza, for example. You know, it's to absolutely 100% eradicate Hamas. However much of Gaza they destroy, they're probably not going to achieve that because they're trying to use military force to a degree that it to achieve things that it cannot achieve.
And so you don't have to be a Christian pacifist necessarily to say it's not that political, like warfare or violence is necessarily always wrong, but actually it's in this instance, the Christian prophetic voice, even from a non-pacifist direction, to say that these wars are fundamentally a failed enterprise because they are trying to achieve something that can only be achieved by hearts and minds, not by the bombs and bullets.
That's right. I think you can be a Christian realist and understand the limits of military force. And in a world which is more complicated, where some of the kind of nation state boundaries we've had are breaking down, where most wars are fought by sort of paramilitary factions, actually, that's been the case for a very long time. Unfortunately, most casualties are civilian, they're not military. You know, you can say that the notion of war being either effective or indeed just, which is a separate question, is extremely problematic. And arguments to kind of about it being either effective in most contexts for most goals, or it being just and limited in the way that the just war tradition is imagined, they look increasingly uncompelling. And I think that, so we shouldn't be too defeatist. You don't need to be a pacifist to accept the things that I've kind of just said, really. I think you just need to be reasonable and realistic about the nature of armed conflict today.
I want to rise to your bait about the difference in pro-life attitudes in the States and in the UK, and particularly looking at the abortion issue, which we have talked about in podcasts previously. What we are seeing in both the USA and in the UK is an extraordinary rise in the total number of abortions.
Yes.
The demand for abortions is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, there were over 250,000 abortions in the UK in 2022. There were over 1 million abortions in the USA. And the difference over the here, we have both very high demand and very high accessibility. You simply need to dial a number. It's a service provided by the NHS. Abortion is and has been recently decriminalized as far as the mother's concerned. In the US, the demand for abortion is just as high. The instinct from the Christian right is it's all about the law. You just got to make it illegal. Once you've made it legal, problem solved. But of course, all the evidence is it isn't. And it's that blind spot about the demand. Why are 1 million people, pregnant women, feeling that they have no alternative but to have an abortion? And what can we as Christians do to find an alternative, a compassionate alternative to abortion, which is, so I think there are blind spots on both sides of the pond. They're equally blind spots. And tragically, on both sides of the pond, the positive, compassionate Christian response, it is there. I spent this weekend at a national organization of Christian crisis pregnancy centers who are providing compassionate, non-judgmental support for women with crisis pregnancy, but it's a tiny little movement compared to the extraordinary level of unplanned pregnancy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I defer to your greater knowledge on those issues, but it does seem that there are both structural issues around families and things like absent fathers, lack of strong families, which mean the choice to go for an abortion is more commonplace. But then also I think a culture of individualism where, you know, choices are seen as being over my body, my autonomy, which I don't, you know, again, that's not really the Christian vision. You know, we have responsibilities to others. We have responsibility, most importantly, to God. So that kind of sense of personal sovereignty, which is really very common now, seems to feed into this. I want to be careful about what I say, just because I don't have that choice to make myself, you know. But yeah, I think, you know, that, you know, maybe as a Christian who would be seen as being on the left, I wouldn't really use that category for myself, but I think other people would. You know, maybe I should talk about that, but I'm particularly keen to hear others who know a bit more, like yourself, John, talk about that, I suppose, and that's helpful.
So, yeah, and one of the mantras that I've tried to repeat over the decades is whenever we as Christians, we say that something is wrong, and of course we do have a calling to stand up and say that something is wrong from a Christian perspective, we must immediately go on and say, and here is a better way. It's simply not good enough. It's sub-Christian for us to be saying it's wrong, it's bad, it's evil, you mustn't do this, you know, because the voice of Jesus was not like that. And the voice of the church at its best is not like that. It says, yes, this is wrong. And look, here's a better way to live. Here's a practical response. Here's where Christians are making a difference. You did it earlier in this podcast when you were talking about the immigrants. You know, okay, it's a massive national problem, but look at this local church. Look at what we're doing. Here is a practical, compassionate response that makes a difference. And we must do that in the life issues as well.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Just before we let you go, John, I think it'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to just probe a little bit further on what I think for a lot of people in the last 2 years has probably been the kind of biggest question they have around international relations, security, conflict, war. And then you mentioned it in passing, the Israel-Gaza war conflict. I've interviewed a handful of Palestinian Christians by Zoom. I haven't traveled to Palestine or Gaza. And what I find so striking is the deep sense of betrayal they feel from the international church. And they say, you know, we expected the kind of hard right Christian Zionists, evangelicals in America. Of course, they were always going to be pro-Israel. But they felt, what they tell me is a deep sense that the rest of the kind of moderate Western church that they thought would be their friends and their allies in what they see and experience as a genocidal conflict have been largely silent, or sometimes they would say kind of too pro-Israeli. I wondered if you had any reflections. I know it's a very broad question on how the church internationally has handled that particular conflict and whether there is a better way, a better story that we could be telling in some of our interventions.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've also had conversations with Palestinian Christian leaders and theologians. I'm fortunate to meet some of them in person, not in Palestine, but when they've been in the UK and elsewhere. And I've experienced exactly the same thing as their deep sense of pain of being forsaken. And really the whole notion of a Palestinian Christian not really being recognized. And if we do say that national identities are plural, we don't make them our primary identity because our primary identity is in Christ. But, you know, if you think about that kind of vision of coming out of the Tower of Babel, that, you know, we have a dispersed sense of many nations rather than a particular single nation, which we're going to assert absolutely over all others, then there's a theological problem around how we respond. And I think, I wonder if there's a kind of, it may be a lack of theological and biblical literacy around the place of Israel in the Bible, which is slightly different from a doctrinal Christian Zionism. It may be there's a kind of residual element of Christian Zionism in those who probably don't fully understand it or not even that interested in it, where they have this reserve about, well, Israel is special. And they may be worried, but legitimately worried about anti-Semitism, things like this as well. And obviously we're speaking in the week after this terrible attack on the synagogue in Manchester. So I think there could be a few things going on there. But I think, you know, obviously some Christian voices have been quite strong in speaking out on famine and genocide in Gaza. I think that that's not been uniform at all. And I think, therefore, the response has to be to step back and, you know, confess sin in this area, to ask for repentance, and then to rethink some of the things, maybe some of that residual Christian Zionism, to really go back to the covenant tradition of Christian theology and say, it can't be the case that we can go along with a narrative that says, because there's this group called Hamas or terrorists, then we have every right to obliterate the place they come from, regardless of the effects on women and children. And that really has been the argument coming out of the Israeli government, large parts of the American church. And it's an argument which at least has not been sufficiently challenged at all across the worldwide church. So I do think there needs to be a kind of a deep need to listen to our Palestinian Christian friends. And there's plenty of online conferences you can go to hear from them, even if you don't get a chance to sort of meet any in person like I have. And then just actually come before God in prayer and say, have I got this wrong? You know, should I be taking a different line on this? Should I be understanding that Palestinian Christians, just as much as British Christians or Israeli Christians or any people group really, are just as much loved by God?
Yeah. And I think it's particularly striking to me because the Palestinian Christians are obviously no friends of Hamas, a kind of Islamist hardline group that has, you know, intermittently persecuted them in where it has power in Gaza. But also Palestinian Christians have for a long time in the broader sense kind of sought and argued within Palestinian society for a non-violent resistance to the Israeli occupation and kind of oppression that they experience in the West Bank and in Gaza. And so I think it's particularly striking to me, looking from the outside, that witness of, you know, we're not seeking to respond to violence with violence. We're not trying to build a kind of national liberation insurrectionary movement, but we do have a prophetic challenge to say that the way that the Israeli government administers the occupied Palestinian territories is profoundly unjust. And that shouldn't be a controversial, let alone an anti-Semitic thing for a Christian to say.
Not at all, no.
Well, should we draw it to a close there? Thanks so much, John. It's been a really fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed listening and learning a lot. Before we end, do you want to just flag up any more of your own work? If people want to read a bit more of what you're writing and thinking about, where should they go?
Yeah, I think if they're interested in these ideas, then the Substack blog, Security After Christendom, is the place to go. My academic writings range widely from political economy of Russia and Eurasia through to theological issues and how we think about politics theologically. But where the stuff that's of wider and public value, I try and write it up there. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I'll try and put a link to that in the show notes of the podcast. People can click through and read some more of John's stuff.
I mean, if you did want to sort of address the Gaza issue more, then there's definitely people I could sort of suggest. Maybe you know people, but people like Tony Dake, who's part of the Center for Study of Bible and Violence that I'm a part of. There's some great people there working on these issues, actually. But he is Palestinian Christian.
Well, thanks so much for your time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to get in touch with us about anything we'd be talking about today, we'd love to hear your thoughts, disagreements, questions, comments. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. You can find Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Lots of resources there, particularly on those kind of life medical ethics issues. And if for some reason you'd like to read some of my own journalism, you can find some of my stuff on my website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.